This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 176, I Got Slimed. Hello, this is Michael Martin, and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is a great day to be part of the Games at Work family and to be here with my friend and co-host, Mr. Michael Rowe. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Michael. It is a great day to be podcasting.
Yes, because if we weren't doing that, we could be doing something else,
yes.
I suppose. I don't know.
We
have a really intriguing virtual reality experience that came across our wire that I hadn't seen before, and I feel a little silly for not having seen this before because it is that super cool. So we had an article come in from TechCrunch talking about the new virtual Star Wars experience, a virtual reality Star Wars experience that's going to be coming to Disney parks. And you and I both saw something along those lines at the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference preview on augmented reality, didn't we?
Yes. And it was actually the team from Industrial Light and Magic showcasing work that they were doing on the Unreal Engine within a Mac development environment. And what was so cool about this one was kind of the interaction between the person in the real world and in the gaming environment, kind of designing and setting up a scene. And so they had an Oculus Rift on with the controllers in hand, and they were showing them in front of a green screen so that you could see a video of the person as they see themselves in the virtual space.
Right.
You know, setting up the scene, putting down some fire, flying TIE fighters over, and then interacting with Darth Vader.
It kind of reminded me of the experiences that we had in Second Life, where E-Pred and others would be in the world and creating the world and manipulating the world. And you could have that experience and see other people doing what they were doing in it. Right.
Yes.
So. And fun that you could represent yourself as a predator, for example, from the movie of the same name. So we were reminded of that when we read the article, and we know that Disney was planning on spending lots of money on their environmentals, you know, that you're walking through the Mos Eisley, you know, cantina, or you're seeing the Millennium Falcon down in the spaceport, that sort of thing. So it made perfect sense that a virtual reality experience could be part of this too, so that you could have something that blends that mixed reality in with the environment. So the article talked about the company. What was it called? The Void? Is that what it is? Yes, The Void. So the company that's making this virtual reality experience for Star Wars has made a virtual reality experience that is part of the Madame Tussauds exhibit, at least in New York, and that was around Ghostbusters.
Yes.
And being the Ghostbusters fans that we are, is like, okay, that is like a ghost to a ghost trap, I suppose. Maybe that's not the right analogy.
So, as Slimer to a cart full of hot dogs.
Ah, there we go. Slimer to a cart full of hot dogs. So we we curtailed our wall pulling activities and went directly to the website and had a chance to watch the minute and a half or so video of the Ghostbusters virtual reality experience. And I was blown away. I was not by a proton pack or accelerator, but I just saw the way that they were articulating and showing the environment of putting on the headset and having the real world melt away. And as you're looking around, you're seeing someone who's in that virtual world with you wearing the Ghostbusters outfit because the computers have painted that on their form, and the environment in very much holodeck Star Trek fashion melting away and reappearing as the environment of the movie for you to walk around with, to blast open walls, to fight the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. This is the sort of thing that I was expecting to see, and I'm surprised I hadn't encountered it before.
Yeah, I thought that was, again, I thought it was really cool the way they kind of, at least for the demo video, right, mixed
right.
real world and the virtual world that the people themselves are experiencing in the video, kind of the holodeck example that you're going back and forth on. What I think would be ideal for a ride, quote unquote, or an experience, quote unquote, like this would be to sell to the consumer a video, a DVD, of them acting it out against a green screen. So as you go into the place, right, you're in this room and you see kind of the physical room, but as soon as you put the gear on and the ride starts, the room should turn into a total green screen, and then everything should be then reflected in on it in a video mashup that they do of you walking around in that world with the activities that you see. Because if you notice the video, what you actually see is not rendering of the people themselves, but the people turning into cartoons. Not quite, you know, Saturday morning cartoon quality, but it is not the same people. Right? They didn't do a full body scan of the users and make it match them, right?
Exactly.
So if they did kind of what they did at the WWDC event with the person standing in front of a green screen, then you could take home with you, after experiencing the event, a copy of the DVD of you in the world as if you were actually in the world. Wouldn't that be cool?
Not only wouldn't that be cool, that is cool. That's amazingly cool.
That would be the way to do this, as more than just a really good, you know, VR experience using Oculus Rift, but something that really takes you into that next level of experience. And it's funny, as we were going through this, I remembered watching a couple of weeks back a person going through Disney's World of Avatar experience. And I found a couple of videos, and neither of them are the video that I'm looking for. This is not the video you are looking for. Move along. but, you know, it's another combination of a really good immersive amusement park environment and sets of VR experiences with goggles and gear. Goggles and gear, I like that phrase, that give the people an immersive experience as if they're going to the world of Avatar.
Very cool. I didn't know that existed either.
Yeah.
But
yeah, so there's some really cool ones out there, and I think we're just seeing this kind of grow and kick off into a total way of keeping amusement parks and amusement rides fresh, because it's a lot cheaper to render the next version of that experience with new cutscenes and new VR content than it is to, you know, rebuild the Hall of Presidents at Epcot Center, as an example.
So given my rants in the past about the differences between virtual reality and augmented reality, and now all these various forms of mixed reality, this particular example of what we've seen here from the Avatar notion that you've shown, the ability of Disney to change your impressions around a physical environment and having that magic that happens when the architecture, the space, the place, everything gives you such a feeling like you're walking into that environment anyway, coupled with something like a VR experience like this, really hits home.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of Ghostbusters, I have to ask, because I don't think we talked about it last summer. Did you watch the new Ghostbusters last summer?
Oh, of course I did.
And?
I thought it was pretty good.
I really enjoyed it. I, you know, there was a bit of an online geeky backlash by some people, which I don't understand. Yes, it was kind of a remake, not an extension of the story, but that's okay. It was fun. I liked all the actors and actresses in it. I thought the story had all the right elements of a good Ghostbusters story. And if you ever watch the Ghostbusters cartoon, every week was the same story.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, they didn't have a lot of new news there. And the plot line, you know, maybe wasn't the absolute best. And there was a little bit of formulaic stuff. So, yeah. But yeah. I liked it.
That's a summer popcorn flick.
That's what you do. That's what you do. All right. Well, let's switch gears here, because this was a great start to launch us into these conversations. And we had a couple of other links that were worthwhile to take a quick little gander at. One of them that I think you saw first, and I thought this was rather interesting too, was a TechCrunch article about LinkedIn using or rather creating a new service to pair people with mentors. And the article talked about it being very much like Tinder, which is kind of funny. But then again, dating sites and connecting people have a lot of affinities with one another, depending on the purpose. And in this case, the notion of linking mentors with people that they can mentor, it's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, I saw this one briefly this morning. That was my base reaction. Just as you said, you know, you have a platform, you have people that show what they do or what they're interested in doing, and leveraging that data to identify mentor protege relationships it's just such a logical extension. And when you think of, you know, LinkedIn as the professional Facebook, where you're trying to build those networks that help your career, this made so much sense to me. And you could do it virtually, because a lot of people on LinkedIn link to people that they've never met.
Right, right. And LinkedIn has kind of warned about that for quite a while, to say, hey, don't link to people you haven't met. It needs to be a strong relationship and blah, 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 blah. And that's true. And I think that's the right and appropriate thing to do. The place where I got a little tripped up, though, in the article was at the end, talking about, you know, it's interesting that this is being provided for free and people are providing their services for free. That there's a difference between coaching, you know, whether it's professional coaching, life coaching, and mentoring. But they also introduced in the article the concept of, might LinkedIn or other networks like this have a desire to monetize this kind of transaction? And that one made me scratch my head a little bit and go, if you are feeling that you want to give back to others in your field or from affinity groups, or you want to pay it forward or whatever, you know, the altruistic elements of this are, how would you feel about doing that if you knew that there was a third party making money off of it?
Well, the way I look at it, any social network or online service like this that provides a free service is monetizing it anyway.
Well, they're monetizing on your data, right?
Right. And so if you are providing your advice and guidance to help somebody advance their career for free, you can do that whether or not you are using a service like this. If you use this service as the matchmaker and then take the mentoring outside of the service because you have a problem with the service monetizing that relationship, that's the way to go. If the service monetized that relationship from the standpoint of, hey, I will help you find a mentor for only $9.99, right? Then I think you have a different thing. Then I think you have a significant issue with, are you leveraging somebody else's goodwill to monetize? And that's where I think problems will occur. And at that point, then I wouldn't use the service at all, right?
Well, yeah, there are plenty of psychological studies out there that show that once you have monetized something or you've put a price or cost on something, it now makes it a transactional approach as opposed to a relationship approach, and that devalues it because you've now got a price tag against it.
Yep. So I think this is interesting because of the nature of the network and the nature of the type of information on the network, and it completely, in my opinion, aligns with the mission of the network. But as you say, if this gets into a monetization model where the network is directly monetizing the link by saying, hey, we'll hook you up with somebody, and then does not remunerate any of that monetization back to the participants of that link, then I have a big issue with it. And as you say, once it becomes a transaction, there are different levels of expectations and norms that come to play. And I think that would devalue the entire concept.
The marginal value of mentoring.
But I could mentor one more person.
Well, so here's a thought. Since you're paying for free services like this with your data anyway, and if the mentoring is happening within the walled garden of the environment, in theory, couldn't that mentoring now be extracted, anonymized maybe a little bit, and then repackaged as an automated machine learning, machine intelligence way of mentoring many?
Yeah. Bot mentoring. It's the Michael bot.
It's the mentor bot, right? And you're making the mentor bot even smarter.
Yes.
So that, I don't know. I'm just maybe too much of a weird idea and too much coffee from early today, but
no such thing. No such thing.
That's true. All right. One other thing that we wanted to bring up for today, and this was something that caught my eye as I was perusing all of the links that we were going to look at today. And I came across these videos from our friends at North Carolina State University and Duke University about how these cube-shaped objects went through the environment where they are and then captured an object that they were intending to capture. So it was they called it microbot origami, but the point was these cubes would come together and then they would encapsulate a particular target object. And just watching how this happened and thinking about the potential benefits and possibilities that this kind of capability could allow for at a microscopic level could be amazing. You know, it could help clean up oil spills. It could do targeted medicines. It could eliminate cancer cells, potentially. I mean, really, really cool stuff.
Yeah. As soon as you found this one, I started looking at it. It reminded me of a book that I'm reading right now. I think we've talked about Neal Stephenson on this podcast in the past. Interesting author. He tends to write books that are way, 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 way too many pages long. And a couple of years back, I picked up his latest book. At the time, it's called Seven Eves. I forgot that I picked it up. So recently, I found it on my Kindle and I've started reading it. The basic premise of it is the book starts and the moon explodes into seven parts. And it goes downhill from there.
Hilarity ensues.
But an interesting part is there is a scientist who is working on the International Space Station and doing some work around asteroid mining and is designing and building these small robots that do a lot of the things that you see kind of in this origami, right? Where they're very, very small, specialized robots that either grab onto things or that string together into threads or cables, etc. And each robot kind of does their own thing. And as soon as I saw this, I was thinking of one of the robots in the book that's used, that basically builds cables. And along that same line, I was watching the show Earth Live the other day, and they were showing weaver ants. And if you're not familiar with weaver ants,
mm-hmm. I know about them.
Yes, they are tree-dwelling ants that will take and weave together leaves in rainforests to build a temporary home to get out of the heat. And as the ants kind of work together to string together these leaves and hold on to them while other ants build out components and knit the leaves together with the silk from their larva, it kind of all got me thinking of this same type of behavior of very simple processes at a very small level can become very complex and powerful tools as you scale them up.
Absolutely. So it's when they're coordinated and
yep. Mm-hmm. So this was really interesting. You know, many of these micro assembly robotics that people talk about, they tend to talk about things like, you know, cleaning up oil spills and having other medical benefits or biological benefits. Not sure how many of those have become practical yet, but it will be interesting over, I'd say probably over the next 10 years to see how fast this science advances.
Absolutely. Super cool.
Very cool.
Well, we are about at the end of our time for today. Yes. So any new games potentially that you're playing or that you're intrigued by?
No, not playing anything right now. I'm playing the rehearsal game and the way too much work to do work game. So really haven't had any time since our last show to dig into any new games. But we'd love to hear from you, our listeners, and tell us what new games you might be playing. So tweet us at games@work_biz with the hashtag new games.
And that's NEW Games, in case you're wondering.
NEW Games, not NU Games, which is actually the name of a gaming company.
All right. Well, Michael, I think we can bid our listeners a civil adieu for today.
Yes.
And we will be back again, hopefully, very, very soon with another edition of GamesAtWork.biz.
See ya.
See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.